just to introduce you to our panelists today, we've got Dr. Shanina Fippi, who's the author of Sex and Citadel, Intimate Life and Changing Our World. It's a fantastic book that you should all read. It's actually how we first got in touch. The book has been translated into 6 languages, nominated for the Guardian First Book Award and the Orwell Prize, award-winning healthcare correspondent with The Economist and presenter with Al Jazeera English, and is also a senior fellow with Promondo. She's currently leading Images MENA, a pioneering study of man masculinities and gender equality in 4 countries across the Arab region, which she's going to be talking about today. We've got Ahmad Qadi, British Iraqi genderqueer writer, performer, and filmmaker, whose films have been commissioned, are now known as BBC4 and the BFI, and they're the creator of musical comedy drag troupe Denim, who have an upcoming run at the Soho Theatre, so you should definitely go to it. They have a fortnightly column for The Independent and a monthly column for The Gay Times. And we've got Dr. Nadia Ali, who's a professor of gender studies at the Center of Gender Studies at SOAS. She's published widely on women and gender issues in the Middle East. Her publications include What Kind of Liberation? Women and the Occupation of Iraq, which was published in 2009. Women War in the Middle East, Transnational Perspectives, also published in 2009. Iraqi Women, Untold Stories from 1948 to the Present, published in 2007. And Secularism, Gender, and the State in the Middle East. Her most recent book, titled We Are Iraqis, Aesthetics and Politics in a Time of War, won the 2014 Arab American Book Prize for Nonfiction. Currently, she's working on a research project about the Turkish-Kurdish conflict. Professor Ali is a member of the Feminist Review Collective and on the advisory board of Kohm, a journey, body, and gender research, which is based in Beirut. So without further ado, Shireen, please take the stage.
Perfect. Thank you very much, Kareem, and thank you, everyone, for coming out this evening. So those of you who follow developments in the region I'm sure you're aware that we had some really quite substantial legal changes over the summer in Tunisia. They introduced a really wide-ranging package of laws on domestic violence, actually gender-based violence. They've even gone further and are trying to amend laws on inheritance. In Jordan and in Lebanon, they closed the so-called "marry your rapist" loophole. And there have been other steps forward. So the question is, you know, these are men in power who are at some level acting on changes mainly suggested by women. But how are average men responding to all this? So a very unscientific measure would be the pop songs that came out this summer in the Arab region. So the first is over here on the left is Rami Sabri. His song is El Ragel, the man. Now, I don't know, men, do we have a live internet connection? I'm not sure if I can click on this. I probably can't. To play you. Can I do this?
Yes, it should work.
Let's see what's going to happen.
If not, let me just go.
Oh, it's okay. I don't know how we're going to get back.
Perfect.
It's a long intro. And it goes on. Okay, so anyway, I think for those who are interested, I'll give you the link. But the translation of the lyrics is as follows. I want to tell you something, so listen to what I say. When a man is speaking, a woman should obey. She shouldn't just say yes with words she'll forget the next day. She should appreciate his value if she wants him to stay. So patriarchal pop, really big in the Arab world this summer. So, in contrast to that, and men, I'm going to need your technical assistance, I think, as well, to get back to where we were. Yeah, fantastic. So over on the right, those of you may know, some of you may know the Lebanese indie band, Mashwa Leila, making a lot of waves, did a concert in Egypt about 2 or 3 weeks ago, which caused a lot of problems for some fans who had the temerity to unveil a rainbow flag and have now found themselves in jail, about 50 of them. Roman, the new song is very interesting. The lyrics themselves are not they're very general, but the imagery in the video and how it's been taken up by feminist groups in Lebanon is to really portray the struggle of women against the patriarchy. So here we have one song which is really full on, same old song, and then here we have a brand new tune. And what's interesting about this is that actually, if you're looking at for sort of empirical, robust evidence on how men are seeing the changing world of masculinities and femininities, we don't have a lot of research in the Arab region, because it's one of the paradoxes that men are the pillars of our patriarchies, both personal and political, but actually gender, as it's conventionally defined in the Arab region, has a female face. Most of the research and the policies and the programs on the ground focus on women and girls, and rightly so, because they are on the receiving end of controls, whether it's in law, in community practice, at the level of the family. But how men see the world, how they see their own position, their lives as husbands and as fathers and as sons, what's happening to them at work, what's happening at home, how they see the shifting sands of their world, and particularly how they see the changing roles and rights of women, is not something that's really been very well explored until now. And it's important within the region, if we are ever going to make progress, not just on gender rights, but fundamental human rights, to bring everyone to the table. And that includes bringing men into these discussions about leveling the playing field between the sexes. But it also has relevance outside the region. And you know, living in Europe, but also further afield, and if you're looking in America as well, I mean, the anti-Muslim, the anti-Arab rhetoric. Here on the left is an article. It's about a sex mob attack in Frankfurt. This was earlier this year. This is the follow-on from the Cologne attacks. And again, there is this presentation of the Arab man, you know, completely stereotypical, completely generalized, as, you know, a sexually repressed yet sexed up sexual predator. And it's not just media, because if you look what happened 6 months later, that is the rise of AfD, which now has about 95 seats in the Bundestag in the recent German parliamentary elections. So how Arab men are seen at home and abroad has really profound implications for policy and everyday life. There's a lot of heat about men in the Arab world. There's not a lot of light, and this is why we did this study, Images. The International Men and Gender Equality Survey, Images, this has become the gold standard of trying to understand what is happening to men in the world. It's a survey which consists of a household. It's a household survey, and it also has qualitative research, in-depth interviews, and focus group discussions. It was created about 10 years ago by an NGO called Promundo, which specializes in engaging with men and boys in, on gender equality. And to date, this survey has been done in more than 30 countries with more than 60,000 men and women. And here you can see the range of countries in which either Images itself has been done or associated studies. Tonight we're going to focus on this study in 4 countries in the Arab region. They are Egypt, Morocco, Lebanon, and Palestine. This is the first time that men have ever been surveyed on issues relating to particularly private life. We talked to about 1,200 men and 1,200 women in each country. So in total, we interviewed close to 10,000 men and women across these 4 countries. The survey, the study was done between spring of last year and spring of this year. The standard Images questionnaire, which has been used in other parts of the world, had to be significantly adapted to the Arab region. As you can imagine, there were some topics that were harder to broach than others, largely because of government censorship. Government censorship in some countries and just sensitivities, cultural sensitivities in others. So these are the three red lines. Politics, out. Religion, nope. And sex, so a lot of those questions fell by the wayside. But we did bring in new questions, and those were actually shaped by our local research partners. So all these studies were done by local academics and local activists, NGOs, who had an interest in gender and wanted to work more closely on questions of masculinities and engaging with men and boys. And they suggested a lot of new issues that we addressed. So we looked at men's attitudes and their decision-making capacities around FGM in Egypt. We looked at the effects of occupation on men and women in Palestine, the effects of conflict in Lebanon, and a number of other issues. In Lebanon and Palestine, we talked to nationally representative samples of the population. In Egypt, we interviewed men and women in 5 rural and urban governorates. And in Morocco, we interviewed men and women in 1 region, the Rabat region, which is a mirror of the diversity which exists in Morocco as a whole. We always had men interviewing men and women interviewing women, and we never interviewed men and women in the same household. And as I mentioned, we did qualitative research, and I should point out that the men and women we interviewed were between 18 and 59 years of age. There is a mass of data. The survey took an hour to complete. It is amazing that we had basically 100%, close to 100% response rates, which gives you a sense of how much people in the region love to talk. We looked at all sorts of issues. Pathways to equality. What do men and women think about notions of the rightful place of men and women, laws that might be passed to equalize the playing field between men and women, the roles of women in the workplace, in public life. We covered all of that. We looked at household relations. Who does what at home? Who does the dishes? Who makes the decisions? Who did that when you were a boy or a girl, your mother or your father? Did you have more freedom to go out as a boy, as a son, than as a daughter? We looked at all this. We had a lot of questions on violence, particularly gender-based violence, looking at violence in childhood, violence in adulthood, both violence within the home, but also street sexual harassment and assault, huge issue in many parts of the region. We also looked at health and well-being and also stress. So again, wealth of information. I'm just going to give you a few snapshots here to get a flavor of what is up with men in these countries. So, or what's not up, because we did get onto some of that as well. Men under pressure. So the huge takeaway message from the 4 countries is that these men are under stress. If you think the patriarchy is great, it works for a minority of the population, which is at the top. And anyone who's down below, you know, mainly women, but also a lot of men, are really suffering. And here is the measure. These men are defining themselves as breadwinners, first and foremost. It's their role to put Aish on the table. And if they cannot do that, then how are they fed? This set of data reflects that. So we asked men, are you frequently stressed or depressed because of a lack of work or income? Do you sometimes feel ashamed to face your family because you don't have enough work? Do you worry about providing your family with daily necessities? These are composite figures. So these are the percentages of men who agreed with these statements. So with the exception of Morocco, we're looking at more than 40%, rising to more than half of men in Palestine, feel really stressed because of largely economic measures. Now, to be fair, we couldn't ask about political pressures. We couldn't ask in Egypt, for example, do you feel oppressed by the political, by the dictatorship? That wasn't something that the Egyptian government was going to authorize us to ask. But, nonetheless, there's a subtext. And I can tell you also that we ask questions, do you fear for your safety, your security? Do you fear for your family's safety? And basically, in all 4 countries, 100% of men, 98, 99, 100% of men, terrified. Really, really frightened for their own safety, family safety, their future, their family's future. Lots of anxiety. Some of this is reflected in depression. This is a standard measure. It's an international measure of gauging depression. It's a depressive scale. And basically, about a quarter of the men, rising to almost 40% of men in Palestine, qualify as depressed. And more than 50% of women. Now, I have to say, we presented this slide yesterday at an event, Karim and I, at Chatham House, and one of our panelists was the distinguished journalist Abdul Bari Atwan, and his comment was, wow, only 50% of women are depressed. I would have thought it was 100. But, you know, this is serious. These are very serious findings. And the stress that men are under does not get a lot of attention, as I said, in policymaking or, in particular, in programming and civil society work on the ground. From the qualitative research, we had these really compelling testimonials from men. This is the nuance to the numbers. And this is a Lebanese man in Beirut who's talking about what happens when men can't fulfill their economic roles. He becomes like a tissue, very easily breakable. In normal times, he is like steel. But when he cannot fulfill his duties, he becomes very fragile. Right, well, given that situation that men are not feeling very comfortable in their skin in the four countries in question, how are they feeling about women's rights and their roles in society? So this is interesting. So we asked, is gender equality part of the traditions and cultures in your country? And basically over here, about half of men and more women said, absolutely not, this is not something that comes, you know, endogenously from our culture. But what's interesting and what's promising for the future is that we ask them, do you think that more rights for women mean that men lose out? And more than half of men said, no, it's not a zero-sum game. It's not that they gain rights and we lose rights. And women were even less supportive of this idea that men would lose out if they move forward. And that's very encouraging because it does give us room to maneuver. We asked so many questions about attitudes towards women's roles in society and men's roles as well. A woman's most important role is to take care of the home or cook for the family. A man should have the final word about decisions in the home. There are times when a woman deserves to be beaten. A woman should tolerate violence to keep the family together. It is a man's responsibility to exercise guardianship. We had a whole panel of these. Again, the numbers are not the significant part. I mean, suffice it to say, you know, large majorities of men agreed with all this, basically. But what's interesting is that many women did as well. So if we look at a woman should tolerate violence to keep the family together, in Palestine, 63% of men agreed with that, but half of women also agreed. Over in Egypt, close to 90% of men thought a woman's most important role is to take care of the family and cook, but it's also close to 80% of women agreed as well. So it's not just men who are holding up the patriarchy for various reasons, it's also women will often subscribe to these notions as well, for reasons that I'm sure Nadja will be discussing. Again, one of the interesting things about the data in the survey is that it didn't come as a nice tied-up package that everyone was internally, intellectually coherent and consistent. There are lots of contradictions. And actually, that's how we know that people are telling the truth. Because we are paradoxical people by nature, all of us. So we asked the question about education. If resources are scarce, it is more important to educate sons than daughters. Well, you know, more than 60% or more of men didn't agree with that. They actually think it's important to educate daughters. And that's interesting because it's reflected in the rates of female education in the region, where in some countries we actually have more women in secondary and post-secondary education than we do women. But if you go to the far right, when work opportunities are scarce, men should have access to jobs before women. You know, 98% of men in Egypt think that's absolutely correct. The vast majority of men agree with this. But also significant proportions of women also believe that men should have access to jobs before women. And this, again, is putting men in this box that you got to make money, and if you can't make money with the double-digit unemployment rates, well, then how are you a man? This is a question about women in politics. So we asked there should be more women in positions of political authority. In Egypt, they weren't too keen on this, actually. The men, about 30% of men, thought that was a good idea. But it's quite high. In Morocco, it's 67%, and in Lebanon, even higher. And, of course, the women, very much. I say of course, but here the women very much want to see more women in positions of political decision-making. Women should leave politics to men. about 60% of Egyptian men think also think that's a good idea. 40% of Egyptian women. But over here, which is really interesting, on the far right, a woman with the same qualifications can do as good a job as a man. Well, vast majorities of men and women believe that. And when we asked men in particular, would you feel happy working with a woman? Now, again, female employment rates in our region are some of the lowest in the world. It's about a quarter in the formal workforce. If a woman does get into the workplace, the men are saying, yeah, no problem. We'd like to work with her. We're no problems working with her. We ask the question, would you accept to work with a female boss? And strong majorities of men also said yes, no problem. Now, they probably thought that was about as likely as Egypt winning the World Cup. But, nonetheless, the willingness is there, and we always have to look at that even when the data looks really bleak, there are these sort of points of light, basically. There are these openings where we can work with men to move forward on gender equality. But one of the interesting general findings which came out of the data was that just because we're moving forward in these laws I mentioned, for example, the legal reforms, it doesn't mean that people really see the connection to their everyday lives. And they often feel threatened by the legal reforms. So here's a man in his 20s, he's in Morocco, and he said, to be honest, it's rare to find a real man. The man has lost his masculinity with these new laws that give more advantages and freedom to women. And a woman, also in Morocco, she's a teacher, she said, she's in her 30s, she said, honestly, the rhetoric on the rights of women, nothing like that exists. It's only talk. In Moroccan families and households, we still live by tradition. We have a culture that can't be remade in a moment. So, again, a big gap between what's happening in political life and what's actually happening in personal life. On the question of violence and control, so huge levels of childhood violence, and it's not just women who are on the receiving end of this, it's mainly men. So here, this is the percentage of respondents who experienced at least one of three acts of physical violence in the home before they turned 18. So this is slapping, pushing, beating with an object, being beaten so badly that you're bruised. More than half of men, rising to a whacking great 79% in Morocco, were beaten as children. And when we asked them what was happening in schools, it was even worse. Up to 80% of men in Morocco remember having been physically punished at school. And also women are on the receiving end of this violence. And this violence in childhood comes back to haunt in adulthood in ways I'll explain in a moment. We asked about spousal control. So who calls the shots at home, basically? And this is a specific type of control. This is husbands, men saying that they control various aspects of their wives' lives, whether they can go out, who they can go to see, what they wear, and in particular, when they have sex. So basically, all men say they control all of that for their wives. And what's interesting is that the women are also acknowledging this control. So the patriarchy, at least in these, and the rules reflected by this, is alive and well in the household. It translates also into gender-based violence in the home. So this is what we call intimate partner violence. That's the international speak on this. Okay, no way any Arab government is going to let us go and interview people about intimate partners. They are spouses. This is your husband and this is your wife. Okay, so just to make that clear. This is looking at different types of physical spousal violence, men's perpetration and women's experience, and also emotional violence. We looked at economic violence and also sexual violence. This is the very first time that men have been surveyed on their perpetration of violence. We've asked these questions, or others have asked these questions, in national surveys of women, their experience, but never of men. And over here in Egypt, for instance, which is really the standout country, basically 45, a little under half of men said that they had ever beaten their wives or been physically violent to their wives, and around a little under half of women also said that they had experienced it. And the emotional rates of violence are really sky high. And of course, the issue of sexual harassment. So it's not just violence in the home, it's also violence on the streets. Here we asked the men who had ever perpetrated acts of sexual harassment in public spaces. These are lifetime rates. So we asked men, did you ever perpetrate? Women, did you ever experience? It's about 65% in Egypt, men and women. much lower in Palestine, but these are significant figures. I need to point out that most of these types of violence were actually ogling and comments, but they did carry over into full-on assault in some cases. This is a quote from a young woman in Cairo to give you a sense of what people were telling us about domestic violence. My husband beat me. When I complained to his family, they said, "What do you expect? Do you want him to take his frustration out on people in the street or in the home? You should tolerate your husband." But my brothers got angry, so they kept me in my parents' home and said that I should not go home to him. And then she went on to say, "I stayed 3 months there, and then my husband realized his mistake and understood that by beating me, he had lost his wife and children. But even then, when his mother came to visit, she tried to convince him that I was wrong. She expects me to be a sponge that soaks up his anger and frustration." So again, in this cornucopia of data, some general themes that have come out. One, men at work. Absolutely key. Men are meant to be breadwinners. If you can't live up to this, as I said, your masculinity is at stake. And it's not just men who define themselves this way, but it's also women who are defining masculinity. Like father, like son, the importance of fatherhood. So we found that men who actually, as adults, got their hands dirty, you know, did the dishes, actually cleaned up, were those who had seen their fathers doing it. Or who, as brothers, or as sons, sorry, as boys, were actually doing the same in the household. The flip side of that was also true, that men who saw their mothers being beaten in the household were more likely to go on to be violent towards their own partners and also sexually harass women in the street. So history counts. The fairer sex, as I said, on certain issues, women's attitudes are often as or more conservative than those of men. This is particularly around issues to do with sexuality, and we'll come to this in our conversations on the panel. The youth gap. This is one of the most interesting findings. So all that table I showed you of all those statistics about, you know, a woman should stay in the home and clean, men should be guardian, we had a whole panel of questions in which we created something called the Gender Equitable Men Scale. It's a way of calculating how open men and women are towards gender equality. So you get a score at the end of this. In everywhere else in the world where we've done this survey, younger men score higher than older men. So that means that younger men are more open on issues of gender equality than their older peers. You know, we don't like to talk about, you know, Arab exceptionalism, right? But this is exceptional for the Arab region because young men in our region were either as or more conservative than their fathers and grandfathers. Complete departure from what we've seen elsewhere in the world. But what is even more troubling is that actually the young women, their female peers, are more open than their mothers or grandmothers. So we have the men moving in one direction, and we have the women moving in another. A huge gap between attitudes and actions. So very often we did meet men, particularly men refugees. We interviewed Syrian refugees in Lebanon, for instance, and we found men who were doing things differently, who were looking after the kids, who were taking on domestic tasks. But very often they were not doing this from some sort of position of gender equality or some sort of ideological stance. They did it because circumstance demanded it. So the actions are often different from the attitudes. Public versus private. Again, we talked about that gap between fantastic, we have all these great laws, but what does that really mean at home? And the women in Morocco actually put this very pointedly. They said, great, fantastic. 2004 personal status code change. Great, if I can get a job, I could go out to work. But then I work all day, and then I come home, and I work all night because I have to do all the cooking and all the cleaning, and all my husband does is just sit and watch the television. And I'm not getting any more control over the finances. So there's the gap there. But anecdotally, we saw, you know, public versus private. There's a great story from Egypt, a woman who said, so we've got this new washing machine. It was very expensive, and it's very technical, so my husband does the laundry. I'm not allowed to touch the machine. But we don't have a dryer, so we have to hang out the laundry to dry on the line, which is on the balcony. And he will never, never, never hang out the laundry because that means the neighbors can see him. So again, public versus private, it's a challenge bridging the gap. And then finally, we had a lot of men and women talk about a crisis of masculinity. What does it mean to be a man now in the region? But in our analysis, we see it more as a crossroads. That effectively, men and women are saying, look, the old models of what it is to be a man or a woman don't work anymore. But we really don't know where we're heading. The sands are shifting, if you like. And we are very uncertain of the future. But within that uncertainty, there is also opportunity. And that is where groups like Promundo and a handful of NGOs now working with men and boys to bring them up to speed and engage them on gender equality, this is where we are finding the hope in leveling the playing field between men and women. Thank you very much. Copies of the summary of the study outside, but for the full study in its 325-page Technicolor glory, you can go to the web imagesmena.org. I thought that
was
right
here.
Yeah,
that's
nice. Should we put all the chairs on the stage? Yeah, right it would be funny if, as the representative of the Arab patriarchy, yeah. I fall off.
But better to fall than be pushed, I guess.
Images mean
So, Shireen, thank you so much for the illuminating presentation. I'll abuse my Arab patriarchy privilege by asking a couple of questions to get the discussion started, and then we'll throw it open for questions so that we kind of have a more convivial discussion atmosphere. Nadia, I want to start with you, actually. There's a quote in your book on women in Iraq talking about the later periods of the Saddam Hussein era, where as part of the faith campaign to try and impose more control over the populace, essentially, they use religion to impose a more conservative society on a society that wasn't that conservative. Mm-hmm. So you say, facing a deteriorating economy and a weakening hold on the populace, the Iraqi state under Saddam Hussein opted to revitalize tribal leaders and conservative practices as a means of stabilizing state power. Those conservative practices were not an inherent feature of a predominantly Muslim country. So, we're seeing places in the Middle East right now where political leaders, like in Saudi Arabia, have, started allowing women to drive, albeit they still need guardians for a lot of institutional issues. In Tunisia, there's a debate over the inheritance law, is the issue of, Muslim women marrying non-Muslim men. Why are states in the Arab world today seeing it fit to, for example, promote some maybe cosmetic changes of gender equality, while at the same time they're cracking down on LGBT rights, for example, in Egypt. Can you talk a bit about that?
Yeah, I think what we're seeing is a very mixed picture. I mean, actually, I don't think that regimes in the region are promoting women's rights. As we say, these are largely cosmetic changes. I mean, allowing women to drive, it's great, but that really doesn't mean there's gender equality in Saudi Arabia happening. But I think the point that I was sort of trying to make with the quote that you're referring to in my book is that I was writing against the idea that there was something inherent in Arab culture or Middle East culture and Muslim culture, and we shouldn't actually conflate the three. They're very different. And now that I work on Kurds in the region and other ethnic minorities, I always get a bit worried when we speak about the Arab world, actually. But I very much try to stress that economic changes, whether they are related to war, conflict, invasion, or changing economic climate, do actually impact on the state's willingness to be more inclusive or more egalitarian. So, for example, in the 1970s in Iraq, Saddam Hussein wasn't a feminist, but he very much pushed Iraqi women into the education sector and the labor force, and the good Iraqi man was the working man working side by side with a woman. And that wasn't because culture changed all of a sudden, but there was a different economic context. And in the context of the sanctions in the 1990s, when you had the state that couldn't provide anymore, jobs were scarce. The good Iraqi woman was the working woman who stayed. No, sorry, was the woman who stayed at home. And actually, it's very similar in Western context. I mean, we have a shift towards conservative values when you have an economic downturn and you know, problem. But I think also one of the things that is really crucial right now is that, and what I think is different from before, is that authoritarian states start to recognize that the struggle against political authoritarianism, central to the struggle against that, is the struggle for gender equality. And while I very much welcome the findings of the report, and I think it's really excellent, and it's, I really welcome it, but I think one of the stories I think that I'd like to, I think it's important to stress, is that there are now men for the first time in the region who actually don't say, okay, let's first liberate the country and then we will look to women's issues. They're actually now men for the first time and say, the struggle for gender equality is part and parcel for the struggle for a fairer, more just society and the struggle against authoritarianism. That doesn't mean that they're, you know, all men are you know, happily embracing that. What we see is this really contradictory paradox society. And on the one hand, you have patriarchy alive and kicking, and I think you provide lots of evidence for that. But on the other hand, you also have, you know, people like Denise Candiotti arguing that patriarchy, as we used to know it, doesn't exist anymore. I don't agree, personally. But in some contexts, we see that because patriarchy, as we know it, has been challenged so much by women, and some men as well, that there is this big backlash and what she calls masculinist restoration. So when the state violently cracks down on LGBTQ activists, or when it cracks down on women on the street who are protesting, it is actually the state realizing, oh my God, at the core of, you know, my being as a patriarchal authoritarian state, you know, this is challenging me. And this is also happening in the family. It's not just on the level of the state.
Connected.
It is connected, of course, yeah.
But, I mean, on the flip side, someone can say that the reformers who introduced a lot of gender equality measures in the region, such as Habib Bourguiba in Tunisia, or, you know, even Ataturk in Turkey, you know, were central to promoting issues of women's rights in the region, right? I mean, is it sustainable to have to rely on the great father figure to introduce those reforms?
No, it's not sustainable. I mean, of course, it helps if you have a political leadership that is, you know, supporting you. But if it's the same political leadership that is saying, okay, we want women educated, we want them to work, but at the same time imprisons everyone who is in political opposition, we have a problem.
Right.
Okay, and we have a problem in that then also we have a form of state feminism where feminists then become co-opted in authoritarianism. And that's what unfortunately happened in the region. And that's why also we see a backlash in many contexts against feminists, because people say, well, they were actually part of the authoritarian regimes. Often unfairly so, because in many contexts, actually, feminists were also challenging the authoritarian state. But, you know, in some contexts, like in Iraq, I mean, either you had to leave, you ended up being executed, or you had to become part of the state apparatus.
Amru, let me jump to you. I love this quote in your movie Nowness, which says, the labor of femininity isn't only the performance. It's perseverance in the face of our ascribed and inscribed precarity. It's a struggle to be respected and have our agency recognized. Can you unpack this a little bit? You know, I mean, talking about, you know, your experience, particularly in, you know, Middle Eastern context. Your family's originally from Iraq.
Iraq.
You know, and also how, you know, what your reaction was to seeing, you know, this expression of agency that happened at the Mashour Leila concert in Cairo, and, you know, the resulting backlash when that attempt was made.
Yeah. To kind of just tie that question into what you were talking about, one thing I've definitely noticed in, like, a domestic context, or definitely in like my family's household who are practicing Muslims, was when I began demonstrating gender nonconformism and was doing drag, and I definitely had to keep that a secret. And their response towards that was that it was kind of like a damage to their collective self, or the like Arabian collective self. And I was really happy to see that quote about sometimes women in Arab households are the bigger enforcer of patriarchal values. And definitely I've noticed, as many other queer Muslims or Muslim drag queens, that their mothers have a far more kind of violent like response towards it. And I think it's interesting because you'd think there'd be kind of like a companionship in femininity or kind of queerness. But I think what happens is when you so visibly non-conform in response to someone who's been so subjected to patriarchal values and who's not been able to escape them, your kind of image of non-conformism or your willingness to be like, actually, I'm not going to be part of this, is a real affront to what they've had to be subjected to. So definitely, and it's something I think about a lot. Like, someone was a Muslim friend, I don't know why I did that, they are a friend and they're just a bit annoying, but
that's fair.
was saying to me about how even individualism was such a Western thing. You know, I think I was like, oh, nobody gets me back home, and I just want to be me. And someone was like, I think that's a really Western way of thinking. Like, that's not how you were brought up. And actually, like, I disagree on many levels, but I feel like I've noticed this in the response in the Iraqi community, because my work's got kind of quite out there, and it's actually really threatened a lot of my family's business and, like, resulted in death threats and, like, a lot of quite genuinely worrying things that make the issue like a lot more severe than just like an abstractual, like, why don't you get my ideology? Like, there are some repercussions. And their response towards it has been like, you're kind of rupturing the collective self. You know, we've all decided to uphold this system and it's kind of working, right? Like, but it's so, and I like that quote about the tissue paper, but it's like, you know, I definitely see with what you're saying in terms of the patriarchy's kind of growing at the moment in terms of the rise of the far right, but it's also becoming a lot more feeble. It's like a sort of bubble that keeps getting bigger, but it's going to pop, like, at any point. And I definitely have noticed this, like, the past 10 years, especially in Western discourse, in terms of how much more aware we are about trans identities and LGBT identities. And I don't think it's a coincidence that parallel to the growing wokeness of the West has also been the rise of the far right in kind of retaliation towards this. And their response has obviously been, as you mentioned, to co-opt minority voices. So Marie Le Pen, for instance, was really successful in you know, winning a third of gay married men in Paris to vote for her, because she was able to kind of persuade that Islam was going to ruin what the West had achieved in terms of civil liberty. And definitely, you know, I've definitely seen this, like, happen in queer spaces, that, like, when I say that I'm Muslim, people are like, you're not welcome here, you know, this is, you know. And actually, I think white gay men, if, you know, it's a different conversation, are one of the biggest upholders of the patriarchy in the West at the moment, because they are able to say they're not patriarchal because of their sexuality, but actually they're white men who are doing loads of kind of oppressive things. It's a different conversation. But definitely, like, I literally don't know what your question was.
that's quite a... Your answer was actually a lot more interesting than my question, so... Shall we? Yeah, let's see if anyone has any questions, and if you don't, like, I'll just keep asking questions. Right back there.
Yeah.
Can you just tell us who you are?
Okay. So my name is Sarah. I'm actually from Saudi Arabia, and this is very interesting for me because we worked with the UN last year. We looked at refugees specifically and the role of men and women in refugee camps and whether. And I'd be interested to know. Actually, I have two questions. One is about finances and whether, because one of the main questions was, would men in refugee, in sort of in refugees, Syrian refugees specifically in Lebanon, Is there a risk of them sort of taking a bigger charge of the aid compared to women? And is there a sort of a risk there, whether sort of the aid is given to women versus men in the household? And the other question is there hope? If we're talking about a situation where most Arab countries are authoritarian, right, in terms of the political regimes, whether it's monarchies or otherwise, if pushing for female rights from the government can be sort of interpreted as you said, sort of something coming from the state and something that's not organic or natural to the society, what is the best way to actually move forward? And how do you go from the bottom up? Thank you.
Right. Shereen, you want to...
So on the question of finances, thanks, Sarah. So we actually, data which I didn't show, was looking at household decision-making. So who has the say on spending on food, on clothing, on major household purchases, and other aspects like the decision whether the kids go to school, marriage, and all that. But on the finance side, it was quite interesting because men, generally in the countries, men said, yeah, we decide. And the women said, well, yeah. So
we work, right?
yeah. Well, yeah, so we actually do make a lot of the decisions, but then we make it look as if he had made the decision. And this actually, I know this from personal experience. My grandmother... My grandma grew up from the Delta, and absolutely. I mean, she was in charge, and then everything was packaged so that my grandfather could say face publicly, because it's the public face. Mm-hmm. It was very interesting in a lot of the testimonials. People were, as I said, struggling between what was happening at home and then what they were showing to the outside world. So, in general, there is a rebalancing of household decision-making going on in many contexts. In the specific case of the refugees, and also Karim can speak to this, the refugee men in particular felt, and this is true not just of Syrian refugees, this is a generalizable situation for refugees, displaced men. They really suffer. Because women on the move, although there are lots and lots of problems that women and girls encounter, but generally when they get to their destination and they sort of settle in, they actually are much more adaptable. They often have much more to do because there's always cooking, there's always cleaning, there's always looking after the kids. Whereas the men, they're not working, so what exactly are they doing? And the men feel really deep dispossessed. In the case of Lebanon in particular, I went to one... refugee camp in Baqa, which was really fascinating because the price of entry to that camp was that you had to have daughters. If you were a family without girls, there was no way they were going to let you in. And the reason for that is that it's in an agricultural setting. The girls were going to work in the fields. And the young men could not find work. And so it was a really, really big problem for them. And one of the issues that arises is the question of how men manifest this frustration. And there's a substantial body of literature to show, particularly amongst refugee men, that it can often bubble up in terms of domestic violence. So in this case of many Syrian refugees, the women actually have much more liberty to move because they're not actually seen as much of a threat by the state, so they're not under control by the Lebanese authorities. Plus, they're the ones who go and get the aid. Now the question: What happens when you get home and you bring the aid home? That's a whole other story. But ostensibly, they seem to actually have much more agency, and many of them do talk about this. We do many more things than we did at home. But this is a problem as well because now everything is on my shoulders. Mm-hmm. These women were saying, and our men folk are just sitting around, depressed and not doing anything. So. Some of the men I met saw it as an opportunity. They actually found value in looking after kids, doing the cooking and all that. But a lot of them just said, we're lost. And where is the future for us?
And, I mean, you know, just to add to that, I mean, the numbers are just... In Turkey, it's got, 3.5 million refugees. 80% of the households are led by women because, the men have either died fighting or, fled to Europe or, are detained somewhere. And in Lebanon, it's the same. It's around, 75%. One interesting element is that a lot more families in refugee camps have babies because it gives them more aid. It increases the amount of money that they get. Last time I checked was last year, I think, there were 40,000 stateless Syrian children in Lebanon. because they were born, but they can't register them anywhere, but they were getting more aid because they were getting born. So that's, you know, on top of the women actually leading the households or working, some of them, you know, were having to have more babies just so that they can have more aid. Nadia, do you want to answer the second question?
Yeah, speak to that question. I mean, partly it's a subjective choice whether you decide whether there's hope or not. I mean, for me personally, I wouldn't be sitting here and bothering if I didn't think there was hope. And I think it's a choice, and I think we need to hope, really, in order to be able to envision a better future and do something about it. But, I mean, I think the trick, one of the really crucial issues is you cannot just look at a man and a woman and think about gender equality just based on gender. A man is never just a man. A man is a man of a specific social class, a specific ethnicity, sexuality, religion, political conviction, and so on, right? The same with a woman. And so when we speak about gender equality, I mean, it wouldn't make sense for me to come into Palestine and just say, you know, women's liberation without also addressing the structural problems linked to the occupation of Palestine. Or, you know, in the Iraqi context, you know, just speaking about gender empowerment, you know, without looking at sectarianism, the impact of sectarianism or the impact of, militia violence, impact of the invasion. So it's really important to look at gender equality and the way that masculinities and femininities are contested in the context of all the other inequalities that are going on. And here, I think, for me, it's very important not to fall into the trap. I think there is a kind of dichotomy. So there are some people who are saying, well, it's all because of imperialism and colonialism and Zionism that we have the mess, you know? And then you have others, oh, it's all because of their religion and culture that we have the mess. No, I mean, we have to look at this holistically. Of course, there are historical and current reasons linked to imperialism and colonialism, but, you know, there are local and regional and national power configuration links to tribe, to religion, families, political parties that are... You cannot just explain away by reference to the outside, and, you know, it's very, I think, in the region, there's always a sort of conspiracy thinking. It's very easy to blame the US and to blame Israel for everything. But no, we do actually have to look inside and be critical and also look very carefully how the inequalities linked to gender, how they are linked to other forms of inequalities.
Let me just take a point that you mentioned, Dumber, for a second. Did you feel that that religion or culture had a stronger impact on or influenced more the rejection of how you defined your own identity?
Yeah. I think, yeah, I could relate that question to your question about hope when I'm with you. I mean, I think hope is actually really political at the moment and it almost needs to be weaponized for good. But definitely when I was growing up in quite a strict Muslim household, it was more the expression of Islam and how it was enforced rather than anything to do with Islam that led me to move away from Islam initially. Like, it was never really... Actually, the best bits for me about Islam were when it was with just scripture and just reading about it and kind of understanding it. But it was more like how it was kind of socially weaponized in the house. And actually, in terms of hope and, you know, when I started doing drag, I initially was like... drag is like the anti-Muslim thing I'm going to be doing, and I was almost like whiting up, and I was like, you know, like really sort of like, and it felt really dissonant to me, and I actually grew even more unhappy. Like, I was like, oh, I thought this is everything that I wanted, but I really hated it. And then, because of someone I met and a few other things, I went back to Islam, and I found that so much of what I was doing in my drag was actually all already in scripture. In terms of, you know, you can, it's like Sufism, for instance, is something that I'm like really inspired by and basically replicate on stage when I'm in drag, like the sense of ritual. And actually, we've talked so much about masculinity, but I think, in terms of what you're saying, public and private, like Arab culture is actually amazingly queer in many ways. Now, might not know itself as that, but when I think about how I interact with my British friends, if there's a kind of social constipation with how like talking with each other and they're kind of, but actually when I go hang out with my Arab friends, my Muslim friends, it's like incredibly emotional, and my mum's kissing me every, like all over, and she's dressed like a drag queen herself. And like, I know this sounds
Arab men kiss, right?
Arab men kiss is kind of really homosocial, you know. There's like constant feasting and there's always a drama, and like I'm like, this is, I know this sounds good, but I honestly felt like, oh, actually all the stuff that like I love about queer culture actually was kind of there at home. So in your question about hope, like there are real pockets of magic in, I think, in the Middle East, and there's this tendency, as you said, I think, to look outside the Middle East. And actually, like, I'm now with a real sense of privilege because I have a British passport, and you know, but going back and finding the bits that I really, really like about it. So I have hope, yeah.
Arab culture is really queer. I can just see that the tagline for Vision,
that's
20,
fantastic.
Vision 2030 Saudi Arabia.
I never thought of it that way. That's fantastic.
So you mentioned religion a lot, all of you, and I was just thinking, what role do you think religious groups can have in helping, contributing in some ways to some of the progress that happens? I mean, I know, for instance, in Iraq, there are a ton of Iraqi feminist groups that are very religious, but also incredibly progressive. So I think, you know, what role can religious movements have in that?
It's a very interesting question. I think you'll find on the ground, if you're looking at civil society groups that are really doing a lot, most of the heavy lifting on women's rights and gender equality in many countries in our region. My experience has been that a lot of them, particularly if they're also looking at sexual rights, are resolutely secular and would rather not engage with religious discourse by and large. And I think that is a limitation, actually, because there's a reason why the guys on the other side, the conservatives, are so effective, because they know the power of religion, and they take it and they wrap it up, and they take sex and they wrap it up in religion, sex and gender, they wrap it up in religion, and then they use it as a tool of social control. On the other side, if we're going to actually connect with people at the grassroots level and really, really get into the interstices of their lives and change their attitudes and actions, then we need to engage with religion, and particularly on issues which I look more at, which is sexual and reproductive life. We have ample scope in Islam for a much broader and much more fulfilling sexual lives than is currently acknowledged. There are some groups on the ground which have tried to engage with religious leaders, particularly in questions to do with masculinities. And the one I'm going to cite here is Zabad in Lebanon, which really is... We don't have many groups that work with men and boys on these issues. Around the world, there are about 800 NGOs. They're in a network called Men Engage. In the Arab region, we have exactly one member of the network, and that's Zabad. So the reason we did this survey also was to generate data so that the groups on the ground that are working with women and girls could actually also start to find ways to work with men and boys. So Abad has tried, particularly in its work in trying to combat gender-based violence, they have engaged with religious leaders to show the commonality of messages, which absolutely, resolutely condemn this. There's absolutely no religious grounds on which to justify this violence. I think Najd is a much better place to talk about, for example, some aspects of Islamic feminist scholarship, which are not so much dealing with masculinities, but are, you know, squarely tackling gender equality. Mm.
Yeah, I mean, so there is, Islamic feminism, which has been sort of growing over the past decades, and you find it actually all over the Middle East, but also actually some of the, in terms of scholarship, many writers are based in the US, interestingly. Mm-hmm. So there's a strong trend of feminist women's rights activists working from within Islam and challenging male interpretation. So I think that, you know, we now have to recognize that they're not just secular frameworks through which gender empowerment is being addressed. However, I would actually challenge your premise in terms of the Iraq. I know sort of better than many other contexts. So I actually don't think that there are religious feminist organizations that are very progressive. Actually, I don't think there are many secular organizations that were very progressive. And our common friend Zahra, who was my student, I mean, that was one of her main findings. She went in there, she lived in Baghdad for 2 years, she studied the women's movement, and she had this very strong idea that she would be looking at Islamic feminist and secular feminist, and they would be so different. And then she actually found that they're very similar on many issues. I mean, they were all vying to get money to do gender-based stuff, and they were, you know, applying from the same funders. And they were, across the board, very, very conservative when it actually came to gender norms and relations, and particularly sexuality. And I'm not just speaking homosexuality.
Yep. There's a fascinating issue with the debate around around this. I always find the American Muslim community extremely fascinating in sort of the debates that they have, because I mean right now there's this discussion about Islamophobia and so on, and a lot of people are saying that, you know, the American Muslim community needs to ally with the LGBTQ community, for example, because...
Strange bedfellows
indeed. Right, exactly. And the people who are sort of, like, standing against that are sort of, like, you know, the traditional, patriarchs of that community. Mm-hmm. Whereas, you know, a lot of people realize that, you know, LGBTQ rights are human rights and you know, fighting Islamophobia requires this sort of alliance, you know, with other activists.
I mean, yeah, I feel like the key, like, word for me that people always, like, is intersectionality.
Yeah.
People are always, and, like, I think representation, it's funny that we bring up US, but, like, media representation, especially film and TV, is, I think, kind of the next frontier in using film and TV and for kind of social progress is going to be highlighting intersectional identities, because, like, especially the US. I mean, I know from, like, when I left uni, was auditioning for stuff, the number of terrorist auditions.
Screaming Arab man, right?
Yeah, you know, bearded man on tube looking suspicious, you know, like, and actually, like, if you, and how helpful it would be to see a protagonist who was intersecting between LGBT politics and Islam, or feminism and Islam. And actually, I think Islam is, a lot of, like, Arabs, actors I know, they're like, oh yeah, I've made so much bank since 9/11, it's great, because, like, the enemy is, like, and I just feel like intersectional identities is, like, people are really becoming aware of that word, but I don't think we're, like, seeing it enough on film and TV, and because I guess it's slightly less binary and a bit clearer as to, like, who's the baddie and who's the goodie and what's going on. But I know the BFI have just released a mission statement, and, you know, their big thing is actually, like, intersectional storytelling.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And I think that will hopefully help a bit in whatever we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
No, I'm glad you mentioned it. I was a bit
really?
Timid to mention the word intersectionality.
Really? No.
But it's been outed. It's come out.
Yeah.
Let's, we'll do one lady, one man.
Let's
go back there.
Yeah. I'm Andrew. I'm Lebanese, but I've lived the past couple of years in Baghdad. I had a couple of questions. The first was, it was interesting the data you showed that more women reported experiencing violence than men admitted actually inflicting violence for some countries. Could we extrapolate, it may be far-fetched, but could we extrapolate from that a sense of perhaps shame in certain countries, or an acknowledgement that they know that this isn't something that they should be doing or admitting to having done? And then others, where that wasn't the case, where, say, fewer women reported it, but more men reported having committed it, a sense of shame at having received it, or being on the receiving end of violence. So that's the first question. The second one, if some of the data shows that women are more conservative on gender issues than men, should, say, the donor community that you alluded to earlier, should they be encouraging, or even, if we're going to be controversial, only accepting, say, applications and doing programming on gender that is coming from men, if we see that that's a more progressive group, older male Arab men promoting gender equality?
Okay, so on the he said, she said, element of it, this is actually true in these surveys around the world. So women, particularly on issues of sexual violence, it's very interesting. I didn't have a chance to show that data, but clearly in some countries about a quarter of women are saying that they ever experienced sexual violence from their husbands, forced sex. And it is possible that the men don't acknowledge it because they don't recognize it as violence.
Hmm.
I mean, this is the whole question of marital rape. Is it your right within your interpretation of the Islamic marriage contract to have sex when you want? And certainly when I showed the spousal control data, they all thought that absolutely that was their right to dictate that. So the sexual violence is one piece. Generally, I think it's hard to know because this is the first time we've asked men these questions. So we know that in the trends of asking women these questions, that if you do this over longitudinally, that you actually see very low rates when you start doing the surveys, and then they actually rise. Now, is that because actually there's more violence happening, or women are more comfortable answering the questions? Is that shame? Because often these surveys are accompanied by national campaigns and there's media attention. So the issue comes out in the open, basically. So women feel more comfortable. I think we can't tell about the men if they're underreporting. Is it because they're embarrassed or ashamed? Or is it because they're just not used to it? This is a bit of a shock for them. The fact that they even answered it all is a miracle. And so what we're hoping to do in these countries is to come back in 5 years' time, and then we'll know. The overreporting is an interesting question, and I do wonder, and that overreporting is significant in Egypt, and I do wonder if that's because actually men think it's more manly to actually be engaging in these types of this type of violence, keeping your wife in line. Again, we don't know that for certain. And this is an area that deserves more research. The idea that the women are patriarchal, therefore and the men seem to be slightly more progressive, and therefore let's give men the money. That's the zero sum game that we were talking about. But flipped over basically. I think no, it's complementary, absolutely. And one of the things we're hoping to do, we don't want to reinvent the wheel. We have fantastic groups that have been working for decades with women on political, economic, social, and cultural rights. We don't want to replicate that. We want to encourage them now to engage with men, because at the end of the day, we can't have parallel streams going. We interact together. The equality is on the same playing field. So the hope here is to actually help these groups become more comfortable in engaging with men. And you need an entry point. And one of the things I didn't talk about, and I didn't show data, is that one of the most positive findings from the survey was just the fatherhood angle. These men love being dads. Absolutely. About 80% of them talk about going to prenatal visits with their wives in all four countries. Now, the wives remember, the men remember going to every visit, but the wives actually don't remember that. They're actually not there all the time. But nonetheless, up to 80% of men in Morocco would like to have paid parental leave. 60% of men in Palestine were playing with their kids or talking to their kids about personal matters. Fatherhood is a really interesting angle in which to try to talk to men, and so we're also hoping that women's rights groups can also engage on the fatherhood front. And this is a way to get in, talk to men about other things like domestic violence. If you want to be a good dad, you don't want to be abusing your wife in front of your children, because it's going to have, abusing your wife full stop, because it will have implications for your child's well-being moving forward. So there are ways of progressing on this.
Do you guys want to say
that it has started to happen. I mean, it has been trendy for the past few years from the UN side to put lots of money in terms of, so the idea that gender empowerment, you need to empower men, or you need to support men. And there are lots of complaints actually from women's organizations who feel that it is unfortunately not that you support men. They're not saying you shouldn't do them, but it's at the expense of them being supported, unfortunately.
I'm not sure there isn't robust evidence to show that it is, as I said, I think the zero-sum game formulation is actually unhelpful, because our experience in the Arab region, and you're absolutely right, Najee, in other parts of the world where Promondo has worked, absolutely there are well-established women's rights groups who have said, this is the patriarchy all over again. You guys do gender equality and then you come and take the money. But in the Arab region, it was very interesting. We never encountered that. And the women's rights groups were absolutely thrilled. And the academics were thrilled that finally this mystery man was suddenly, we're going to get some insight. And one thing I didn't mention is that we had 8 teams leading this study, and 6 of them were led by women. And one of the most amazing things that we saw in the process of doing this research is just the men who were reporting to women, female superiors. It was fantastic. The engagement, the interaction, the dynamic of these men truly respecting their colleagues, truly, you know, looking up to them for advice and leadership. So I think there's a danger.
I think we might be speaking to different women. I think the women that I'm talking about are, I mean, it's, I guess, sort of more in development and in, but also women's rights activism. And they do feel that, I mean, I'm thinking Jordan, Egypt, Iraq, Lebanon as well, where there has been over the last few years sort of this recognition that, you know, for a long time, gender mainstreaming was ticking the box and it was sort of focusing on women. But now, unfortunately, in the context of many kind of UN projects, it means gender mainstreaming is sort of ticking the box and addressing young men. That's at least how women have told me that they're experiencing it. And they experience, and unfortunately, and I mean, I totally agree with you, it shouldn't be, you know, an either or. But we know, I mean, someone who saw that there was all this money put into Iraq in 2004 and 2005 as part of, you know, to bring democracy to Iraq. All these projects stopped, and then, you know, the money went to another country, actually. Then in after, you know, 2011, Egypt and Tunisia. I mean, it's a very short-term span, the way that I think sort of development and gender mainstreaming works internationally.
Yeah. I mean, Amir Ashour, who runs Iraqueer, talks a lot about this with me, about how we really... these sort of splinter groups or reactionary groups need to happen ground up on that level without an external resource, because actually when those resources leave, it leaves such conflict, like he was telling me about, you know, how since, you know, Western's invasion and then like this trying to set up democracy in Iraq, like ISIS specifically have said LGBT people are the cause of all these people. And we don't know specifically like how that can be like legitimized, but I think that is like gives an indication of this like danger of like someone coming in and out, when actually I think it's an internal language that needs to develop. And like I'm just kind of conscious about that kind of dip and do sort of mechanism.
Can I just pick up an extra point about the money going to young men? And I think that's interesting, because it's not going to young men on gender equality, it's going to young men because they're concerned about radicalization. So the men are often seen through this really narrow lens, and I think the key is actually broadening, if you were to broaden that, to look at really gender as being men and women in its conception. I think that would be a much more much more robust foundation.
Let's just go one more question here.
Thank you for fascinating research, I think. My name is Latif Tesh. I'm also a researcher at SOAS, working on Kars and Turkey and its diasporas. My question would be two short questions. The first one, because I'm doing ethnographical work as well, and then when it comes to data, comparative data, we'll be skeptical who we are comparing with who. When we look at the class space, when we look at the urban and rural area, and when also look at the different education, and you know, that's how the research, the focus of research becomes important. You know, which part of cities they look at them, and that's my first question. The second question would be, and all research, especially in Turkey, we find out actually conflict, the existing conflict, directly affect the violence and masculinity and patriarchal norms. But we know also there is continuing of conflict in the Middle East. And how much this conflict affect your data, your answers as well?
So in terms of the different groups, absolutely. I mean, we didn't have the time to go into the granularity of the data, but we have broken it out according to urban, rural, levels of education, wealth. I mean, what's interesting, as I said, for the men, is that by and large in most of the countries on a lot of these gender issues, they vary according to education. Definitely, but urban-rural wasn't making that much of a difference. Interestingly, in Egypt, for
for example, in a lot of their responses. And it really, it's the age question that was most striking, that age for men does not actually seem to have a differential effect on their attitudes towards gender equality. On the topic of conflict, I didn't have time to go into that, but we have an entire module on that, particularly in the Palestinian context. And just, you know, some of the top line findings, we looked both in the qualitative and the quantitative about experiences of occupation, whether it's detention or it's displacement or physical violence, discrimination. And certainly men who had experienced these types of violence were much more likely to be depressed, unsurprisingly, were also significantly more likely to be violent towards their wives, and were also more likely to sexually harass women. So in terms of, and very clearly, connection between the political and the personal. And we also looked in our qualitative research in Lebanon, the experience of displacement and conflict on Syrian refugees, and also on Palestinian refugees. And I should also point out that over the course of the next month or so, each country in the study will be issuing its own national report, and that will be the very deep dive into exactly these really specific questions that you've rightly raised.
I'm very conscious of the time. Do I have 5 more minutes? Okay, great.
I'm often very interested in the way in which there's a polarity between East and West, and we tend to forget within that discussion that, in fact, women in the West were also somewhat, and still are, don't actually have equal rights. We're still fighting for that.
As hashtag me too.
what I'm interested in then, with regard to the questionnaire, the survey we've been doing, was it ever done with women in the West? And what would be the comparison be in terms of the response?
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to take more than one question?
I'm fine, but I'm, like I said, least interesting person here, so you guys.
In relation to the question that you asked about shame in terms of men admitting to violence, with this whole Me Too campaign, you know, I couldn't help but think, why is the agency on all the women to confess Me Too and not the men to say sorry, kind of complicit, or actually I knew, or actually I did this? It feels like there is a, and I've actually looked on Facebook and some of them
started hashtag I did that.
Oh, hashtag I did that. Is that happening now?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. So I was a bit again.
Australian guy started.
Sorry?
Australian journalist started.
Ah, interesting.
Okay. But it's interesting, even the levels of getting to that. It's like, and I just find that kind of interesting. And also I've been reading that it's always saying violence against women, where the woman is this kind of passive object to violence. There's no rhetoric which says the men are doing the violence. It's always the women have kind of received it.
So as usual, the women came first.
Yeah, the women.
We did, so the survey, interestingly, it has been done in some Eastern and Central European countries. One of the foundation stones of images was something called the Gender Equality Survey, which was actually pioneered in Norway. But that was some time ago, and so they're hoping to do another round. Companion study was done in the US, UK, and Mexico around the same time as we were doing images by ProMundo, and it interviewed young men, not young women, young men, between the ages of 18 and 34. And what's really interesting is that they found very similar findings in terms of young men who said they wanted to control where their girlfriends... So the phrasing is different, the framing is different. Where their girlfriends go, you know, husbands shouldn't be expected to do housework. And so a lot of... We were seeing extremes in some of our countries in the Arab region, but again, it's just a spectrum, isn't it? And we're all on it, just at different points, at different times.
We've actually progressed somewhat because there was the women's movement, progress was actually made, and this country has to be spread. So I'm sort of thinking that in 20 years' time or in 30 years' time, is it going to have changed there as well?
Well, I mean, it has changed. I think it's really very important to not portray it as a sort of static region. It hasn't changed at all. I mean, it's been changing all the time. And I think one of the things that the report points to, but also sort of the wider picture, if you do qualitative research, it is a totally mixed bag. It is full of contradictions. It's full of paradoxes. I mean, it's even in the 90s when I did research amongst Egyptian women's rights activists, my God, the kinds of things women were doing then, and when you think about women in the region who are doing all kinds of things, whether it is, politically or creatively. I mean, speaking of hope, like in Egypt, for example, yes, the revolution did not succeed, but, we cannot really go back to what was there before. I mean, young women and men are involved in all kinds of creative expressions to actually challenge prevailing culture and prevailing gender norms. And, of course, things will change in 20 years, but we don't know in which direction. I mean, in this, like you say, in the West, I'm worried about the way that things are going, and, we might have sort of a shift towards more right-wing, social conservative gender norms. But actually what I feel, and I'm really glad you say this sort of dichotomy East and West, what is actually happening very similarly in the Middle East and in Western contexts, whether it's Europe or the US, is that societies become more polarized. Mm-hmm. And I think there is increasingly a kind of coming together of people who are kind of progressive and believing in more sort of egalitarian societies, just societies, who are anti-authoritarian, and where gender-based equality and also a challenge of heteronormativity is at the heart of that project. And then on the other hand, in the Middle East and in Europe and North America, you have a growth of right-wing extremism that is extremely conservative and regressive where gender norms and sexuality is concerned, actually.
So are the AFD the Muslim Brotherhood of Germany?
Well, I mean, they don't have that religious, I don't think they're particularly Christian, I'm not sure, but they're certainly part of the right-wing movement that cuts across east, west, north, south.
Shall we do one very last question? But it has to be really quick, right?
I'm very interested in one aspect of something that you've mentioned, Shireena, that most of the surveys were done under spouse, or most of the questions were targeting or addressing spouses more than intimate partners. Would there be... Do you think that there would be a marginal error if the statistics are viewing the intimate partner or lover? Is there any differences between the gender binary of the interaction between the two genders within a relationship, be it, as you mentioned again, the contrast between what happens outdoors and what happens in an intimate context, in a private context?
You need to keep in mind that these are small samples, so there are 1,200 men and women. And to be honest, if I look at Egypt, for instance, what is your chance of living with someone else if you're not married, basically? I mean, Beirut is a different story. But again, it's a minority of a minority, which you're not going to pick up in these sort of household surveys. I think what would be interesting is to do that work qualitatively and to go and do in-depth interviews. And there, yes, you might see some of the distinction, but not in a survey. But thank you. We'll add that to the list of questions. We're going to do images 2.0 in the region, so that'll be on the list.
Well, all good things come to an end. So if you can join me in thanking our wonderful panelists.